Welcome to installment number 6 of the Shattering Triangles Project lectures on priesthood. And we just finished doing a 5-part series on the doctrine of prophets. Really happy about that and excited about it. But now it's time to switch gears completely in this project and go into the next stage of doctrines we're going to be discussing and principles having to do with the doctrine of Christ and knowledge and the process of repentance, faith, sanctification, and everything that is found within the doctrine of Christ. And we're going to start with a really kind of maybe a weird place in this particular presentation called Mormon Gnosticism. And for today's discussion, I've invited a good friend of mine who I've known for quite a long time named Kara Hudson. And welcome, Kara. Thanks for being on here today. I appreciate it.
Hi.
So Kara and I've had some really great conversations over the years about these topics. And she's a lot like Kristen, where she has really, really great questions. She's on her own personal journey as a committed member of the church who is seeking greater light and knowledge and seeking a greater connection to the Lord. And like all of us have tons of questions that she's working through. Is that a fair representation of you, Kara?
Yeah, that sounds pretty spot on.
So we've had some pretty great discussions over the last few years. And so I'm excited to kind of go through this presentation with you and see what comes out of it. If that's okay.
Let's go.
All right. So what is Mormon Gnosticism? Why am I even bringing this up? Well, this presentation is a bit of a response to a growing trend within the church and within those groups that are supportive of the church that have been making this this argument that there is this increasing movement called Gnosticism within the church. And it's a criticism that's being made against broadly towards different groups of people that they sort of throw into all the same bucket. So they might take preppers and people who are studying and interested in the book of Isaiah, to those who study a lot of the entire doctrinal corpus of restoration theology, focusing on Joseph Smith and the calling and election major, and those who are seeking greater light. Now, within that group, you're going to find all kinds of different sorts of people. You're going to find people who are very, very grounded and moving methodically in faith and stability through that. But you're also going to find people who don't. And just like in the mainstream church, LDS church, whether you're a Catholic, whether you're a Protestant, whether you're a Jew, no matter what religion you're in, you're going to have a spectrum of people who are very, very maybe conservative or mainstream. And you're going to have people who are sort of fundamentalists, and you're going to have people on the fringes. And so that is a phenomena you're going to find everywhere. But I'd like to address this idea of Mormon Gnosticism because it's become sort of a baseball bat that people take to groups of people. And I think that the accusation is unfair and sort of misguided, but at least it's at a minimum, it's really unhelpful because the criticism itself is so vague and imprecise that it creates a lot of accusations that are unfounded and even undermine the central principles of the restoration. So we have to untie these things because if we don't, people can get caught up in these types of criticisms, and then they can become disconnected from fundamental truths that they shouldn't be disconnected from. And so I want to address this idea of Mormon Gnosticism. From the get-go, I'm using the word Gnosticism because it's a word that's been adopted by those who are critics. And so I'm going to address this idea of what Mormon Gnosticism is. Does that make sense at all, Kara? I'm trying to maybe intro people to this idea who may be hearing this for the first time.
Yep. Makes total sense.
Okay. So Mormon Gnosticism, it's a funny thing because there is, I believe, a reason why this term is used. And we need to explore what Gnosticism is, which is a really hard thing in and of itself, because really Gnosticism is this, it's not even a religion. It's sort of like it's like a religious view or a structural view that's broader than any religion. And it's so broad that it's very, very hard to even like kind of like tie down what exactly it means. Gnosticism is really like mostly something like a theological philosophy that was more popular just after Christ, like in the early ages of the church. And what we knew about Gnosticism until like the early, like the mid 20th century, was mostly what we learned from the critics of Gnosticism as a movement. And so a lot of what we know about it is from a critical standpoint, which isn't necessarily bad, but it doesn't necessarily give us a true picture. But there's some basic premises of Gnosticism that people, that they kind of hold on to. And one of the principles is that one of the tenets or ideas of Gnosticism is that there's something called hidden knowledge, and that through the possession of knowledge, one can or one must know God. But what the Gnostics believed about that is really, really broad. There's people who believed from a real strict Christian view, you know, apostolic view of the early fathers. But there's also very much other people on that spectrum who believed through like kind of like what we would call a New Age view that was detached from a resurrected Christ. And so a lot of Gnostics believed, were sort of like immaterialists. They wanted to divorce the materialism from the church, and that anything that was material was, they believed, fallen and not of God. And so I'm trying to give you a really quick snapshot that a lot of the early Gnosticism was criticized, and I believe rightfully so, because it would like deny the resurrection or the idea that Christ and God could come and set their kingdom up on earth, because nothing material, materialism was so inherently evil that it couldn't contain anything godly in it. Point of it though is that Gnosticism, calling something Gnostic is so general, it's like calling something spiritual. Like it has no meaning unless you want to impose or project the meaning that you want it to have on it. And so when you call something Gnostic as a criticism, it's really a form of shadow boxing. And that's why I have this picture up, because shadow boxing is sort of like you kind of project the enemy that you want to have and then you beat it up. And it really doesn't serve the truth, because the enemy you're projecting really doesn't represent the group of people that you'd like to criticize. So you're shadow boxing something that's not really even there. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So if you want to be effective and make a point, become a good shadow boxer, make up an enemy and then go beat it up. And then tell people that your enemy is something that it's not. And it makes it look like you have effective arguments, but in reality, again, it's not really serving the truth. And this is kind of the idea of sophistry. Sophistry presents itself, you know, all over the place throughout time. And what sophistry is when somebody, sophists are like people who are skilled in rhetoric or philosophy, and they use very effectively, perhaps, something called fallacy. And a fallacy is using an argument that's not actually logically sound, but it seems like it's logically sound. And sophists have the ability to layer fallacies upon fallacies in order to make a convincing argument, even though their arguments are fundamentally unsound or untrue. So sophistry can be very dangerous. And you see it throughout religions, you see it in politics, you see it in academia, you see it anywhere where ideas are being contended with and there's discussions. Sophistry is the temptation of very, very smart people who desire to persuade towards a prejudice at the expense of truth. And so we have to watch out. We have to watch out for sophists within our ranks and from our critics all the time. It's something that you have to be very, very aware of. And I believe it's an element of sophistry that's employed this idea of calling people in the church Mormon Gnostics. So my friend Cameron Mayer has this great analogy. He says it's, you know, arguing with sophists is kind of like arguing with a sandstorm. It's like debating a sandstorm. that there's like so many moving parts, nothing solid, everything's moving around. The sandstorm itself is ominous and threatening, but the reality is you can't really argue with the sandstorm, because the moving arguments are so erratic, unstable, and cloudy that it's really, really, really hard to unwind. So I love the idea of arguing with a sandstorm. One way that sophists use effective arguments is through what's generally called an induction fallacy category. I don't want to get too like technical into what this is, but I can make some examples real fast that'll make sense. And so I'm going to run these by you, Kara, and see what you think, okay?
Yeah.
So induction fallacies are kinds of arguments that people make that sound true, but they're not once you start to kind of really think about them. So let me give you a couple of examples of different types of induction fallacies. And what's hard about an induction fallacy is that really closely replicates the idea, not the idea, but the principle that by their fruits you shall know them. So, you know, this is the principle, of course, that if you want to know if something's good or not, like a seed, like we talked about in the prophet videos, you just look at the fruit that it produces, then you can know what kind of seed it was. And this is a scriptural principle, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can kind of take that structure of discernment and you can turn it on its head and you can make it look like a by their fruits you shall know them argument, but really it's not. Let me give you some examples. Well, this is an example of something good. So, you know, repentance, you know, the seed of repentance when it's planted creates a tree of love. And that's how you know repentance is a good thing, because love is the fruit. Pretty straightforward, right?
Yeah.
So another example is faith. You plant the seed of faith and it produces knowledge. And that's another way that you know that by their fruits you shall know them. That good faith produces righteous and good knowledge. Now, what if I said, hey, there's a blue dog. Look at that dog. It's blue. And since there's a blue dog, all dogs must be blue. That on its face is so like, it's such a contrasted argument. That's pretty obviously false though, right? So yep. It's easy to see that, you know, but what's funny about this is that argument's used all the time. It's just not so obvious. Okay. So you laugh at like, yeah, of course not all dogs are blue. But look at this argument that uses the same argument. Christianity and war. Hey, look, there's a war and Christians are in it. Therefore, all war is a product of Christianity. Or you see that with religion,
mm-hmm.
Right? There's religion, there's wars, there's devout, faithful members of those religions in those wars. Therefore, religion creates war. So do you see how all of a sudden what was kind of a funny example of that argument becomes, oh, actually, that's kind of okay. I kind of see what they're coming from. You know, all of a sudden you get into this cloudy area of, wait a second, is that true? You know, like, yeah, I guess most big wars are religious oriented. And all of a sudden, these types of fallacies start to take upon deeper and deeper reflections of truth that appeal to the passions and prejudices of people and can bring them into believing something false because that argument looks so close to the truth. Can you see how easy that would be?
Yeah, I hear it a lot. Like,
yeah, you hear it all the time, right?
If we got rid of religion, there wouldn't be any war.
Yeah, it's a really common argument, but it's a really, really it's a fallacious argument. It's really, really, but it's a very sophisticated one. We hear this one a lot lately. You know, you have someone who's racist, they do something racist, like a police, you know, brutality type of thing. And then you extrapolate from that all white people are racist or all cops are racist, right? Mm-hmm. Like this argument, this debate's being held, you know, pretty, you know, relatively currently in our society. You know, the argument that we're wrestling with is this sandstorm once again. It is based on a sophisticated sophistry. You know, sophistication actually comes from, I think, the same etymology of sophistry. It's really interesting. but it is a fallacious argument that really clouds the water of truth, and it appeals to the prejudice and biases of people to get them to believe in a certain ideology. We hear this with the church all the time too. Mormonism. Look what comes from Mormonism. Look, you have the Mountain Meadow Massacre. They were all Mormons. This is a type of inversion, sophist argument where they say, okay, look, we had the Mountain Meadow Massacre. Does everybody see where Mormonism eventually leads? Like, if you're a Mormon, you may not be a murderer today, but given the right formula and circumstances, Mormonism inevitably leads to, some sort of genocidal massacring of people if the circumstances find themselves in that right place. Therefore, Mormonism should be, defeated or outlawed or exterminated, because nothing good comes from it. Only murder comes from it eventually. You see it all the time with, like, you have these examples of corrupt state presidents or bishops, financial fraud or abuse or something. And then people, the critics of the church will come out and say things like, well, because of these examples of corruption, it must follow that Mormon leadership is corrupt, or that it's what, if you could uncover it, you would find that most of Mormon leadership either produces corruption or is already corrupt. And it's just a matter of time of finding it. So you see how, like, these really funny arguments that are really obvious on one level aren't so obvious on another, but can be used really, really effectively to make bad arguments that are so cloudy that if we don't take the time to really think through and drive truth, then those arguments can actually consume us and confound us without us really knowing what the truth is. You kind of see what I'm driving at?
Yeah.
So the point I want to bring this all up is because I think it's really important for people that have a clarity of understanding of, like, the types of attacks they can be receiving without really knowing that the people who are making those attacks may be doing so knowingly or even unknowingly. But regardless, sophistry is a method of convenience to convince somebody using prejudice and using persuasion to believe something that really doesn't hold up under the weight of truth. And so it's really important for us to always be first and foremost committed to truth, driving towards the understanding and getting clarity. It's the only way you really can overcome sophists, because, we have four examples of sophists in the Book of Mormon, and we call them antichrist, because antichrist uses the methodology of sophistry in order to convince the people to deny God or to deny their religion or their covenant. And so, the four examples of antichrist in the Book of Mormon are some very, very good archetypical examples of how sophistry works. So in the end, sophistry is a type of antichrist, because Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. And it's using sophisticated arguments to deny God or his truth or his doctrine. So it's really important to point it out and to understand it so that you don't become overcome by sophistry and those types of arguments. So there's an inherent dishonesty in it, but I don't really necessarily want to impugn people's motives, because sometimes people fall into it just because they get kind of like caught up in it and they don't really understand that it is dishonest. But at some point, whoever originates the argument, wherever it comes from, it always comes from the adversary, because he's the father of all lies. And he teaches people who are susceptible or vulnerable of either how to believe it or to echo those types of lies. And that's why it's really important that we can discern them, detect them, and overcome them. Okay, so Gnosticism is sort of in this category. Now, there's a lot of people who use this. I'm not calling them like evil people, but they may have been persuaded by something that is fundamentally like incorrect and fundamentally flawed, and those flaws can actually have ripple effects to really actually do damage to truth and do damage to true doctrine. So let's talk about, without unwrapping the total like idea of Gnosticism, because it's so vast and would take like 10 hours. Let's just kind of look at a couple of the basic tenets that people kind of grasp onto And oops, I had two slides at once. Okay, why do they use the word Gnosticism? Well, first of all, I think there's a couple like tenets of Gnosticism that someone could kind of probably borrow from and then extrapolate or leverage to make an argument, even though it has very, very little to do with Gnosticism itself. But I think one of the reasons why people use it, Kara, is because Gnosticism just sounds like spooky. Like, ooh, look, they're Mormon Gnostics. Like, pretty much like no one knows what Gnosticism is, especially like in the mainstream church when you have no, like, you know, I mean, when you're not like formally like either reading about or educated in theology or philosophy, the chance of you having like a deep understanding of Gnosticism is like probably close to zero. Like, have you ever like studied Gnosticism on your own as an example?
Like the Gnostic Gospels.
Yeah, like you've come across that, right? Like some of the stuff they found in the 20th century. But unless you're like seeking out books, you know, or you're really seeking it out, the chance of you knowing what Gnosticism is pretty low. So it's like a really like vague term. And if it's used as a criticism, I think it's effective because it sounds spooky. It's kind of like how people say neo, you know, like you'll say, oh, he's a neo fundamentalist, or he's a neo conservative, or she's a neo progressive. It's like, well, mostly the reason why people use the word neo is because it just sounds like, you know, there's an emotional connection to neo-Nazism, which is where it kind of was used first. And so it sounds spooky. So it sounds dark and it sounds like scary and dangerous. And I believe that's why Gnosticism was employed in one regard. There's an inherent like dishonesty in it because it's actually trying to conjure an emotion more than it's trying to conjure clarity and truth. Also, one of the basic tenets of Gnosticism is this idea that there's hidden knowledge. But the way that a lot of those Gnostics use that, and that's the problem, is you have these big, huge, different strains of Gnosticism. Some of it use it, I think, in a really righteous way. Some of it use it in a really non-righteous way. But if you conflate all of it and then call it all bad, you have to unwind it. And then you can use it effectively to criticize somebody. But they're kind of borrowing from this idea of hidden knowledge. But beyond that, they don't really use Gnosticism except for the fact that they can like Wikipedia the term and see hidden knowledge and go, oh, I can leverage that. So again, it's really, really like there's not a lot of integrity in the use of the term as a critical point of view. So to borrow from one of the talks or the addresses an apologetics group made for the church against what they call Mormon Gnosticism, where they've coined this term Mormon Gnosticism that's gaining popularity. I'm borrowing from a quote and they're using this as a criticism. They're saying, hey, look, there's this like really dangerous strain within the church of people who believe that esoteric knowledge, hidden deep doctrine, is necessary for fulfilling our spiritual potential, and that seeking for it is more spiritually advanced. And but they're saying this from the perspective that this is very dangerous. This creates people like Chad Daybell or whoever else your cast of evil, evil villains are in the church. That there's no other, you know, if you think that there's like hidden knowledge and you need knowledge for spiritual advancement, then you are somehow like really deceived. And the chances of you at some point becoming, you know, the new version of the Mount Meadow Massacre is super high. And all of these arguments are leveraging these sophisticated fallacies of induction in order to make an argument that appeals more to their prejudice than a rigorous spiritual doctrinal critique. They start invoking things like mysticism and spiritualism, and they use these things so vaguely that it all just sounds dark and scary, elitism, secret knowledge. And they start combining all these into a big bucket of cold water, then they pour it on their audience in hopes that they have the same shivering response. But if we untie these things and we try to drive truth into it, we're going to find very, very quickly that criticizing members of the church for a belief that there's esoteric knowledge and that you need knowledge for spiritual advancement is very, very misguided. So much so that it actually undermines the central premise of the restored gospel, which is spiritual knowledge is the path of exaltation. And we're going to use the balance or the remainder of this presentation to actually explore that fact. Esoteric, a little bit more well-known term, but it also sounds spooky a little bit. It just means that it's something that's known or understood by a small group of people. Now, as a criticism of esoteric knowledge or hidden knowledge, it finds itself in really sketchy ground almost immediately by virtue of something we call a temple endowment. Because the whole idea of the temple endowment is to administer an endowment of knowledge that is only given to a small group of people, only understood by a small group of people, and is contained to that group of people because it's sacred, but it's given under the conditions of secrecy to be maintained and kept. And that progression of knowledge is the requirement to actually become exalted. You're given secret signs and tokens to gain knowledge, and it's all required to be exalted. And it leads to this progression to come to a veil to receive greater light and knowledge. So anybody who, I think, takes a step back, spends 5 minutes thinking about the temple endowment, knows immediately that there's inherent weakness in making an argument that, hey, the restored gospel isn't about knowledge and it's not about like a small group of people who can obtain it. That's almost definitional of the restored gospel. And we're going to see more and more how knowledge and obtaining knowledge is what's uniquely different about the restored gospel. This is what the fullness of the gospel is about.
This concludes part one of Knowledge and Salvation. We are going to go ahead and continue in part two, where we will review at a very high level a number of quotes and scriptures that support the premise that knowledge and salvation are inextricably tied and are the foundational principle that Joseph Smith revealed in the restoration of the gospel.